Welcome to episode 11 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. My name is Randy Wilkins, and as always, I'm joined by Yankees beat reporter from The Athletic, Chris Kirshner. Chris, how are you?
Doing great. Just came back from a wedding in Orlando this weekend. I missed Saturday's game, but I had a watched Friday's game on the plane. My flight was actually delayed, so I had plenty of time to watch it. And then Sunday's game, I watched it on the plane coming back. But missed Saturday's game. It seems like that was the one to miss.
I feel like you're at a wedding every other day now, or every other week.
I got a lot of friends. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I'm a little disappointed that the Yankees didn't sweep the Astros, because I was very... I was ready to open the show with Meet the Grams by Kendrick Lamar.
And yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah, I was going to force an episode in there if they swept the Astros, just to play that song. But, you know, the Astros got in the way of my dream. So maybe we'll do it another time.
I'm sure there will be plenty of times with how the Yankees are playing.
Yeah, which is a good thing. So, we're excited to have another special guest with us this week. We're joined by Yankees and Mets reporter from SNY, also the author of the book Cheated on the 2017 Houston Astros Scandal, speaking of the Astros, and author of his new book, The Yankee Way, which covers the Brian Cashman era of the New York Yankees. We're joined by Andy Martino. Andy, how are you?
What's up, guys? Chris, how old are you exactly? I'm sure you're considerably younger than me. I'm going somewhere with this. How old are you?
31.
Okay, that's the wedding age. That's the age where you have fun weddings to go to.
Yep.
On a lot of weekends. And then what you'll find in about 5 to 10 years is you'll enter the friends or divorcing period of your life, where you go, well, it was a fun wedding. It's not as fun of a phase of life, but you know, that's coming next.
Yeah, no, I'm not looking forward to that. I think marriages are like 50% last. Or it might even be less than that. I don't know.
How about the one that you went to on Saturday? Are they going to make it?
I think so. I hope so.
Good.
This friend is someone I've known since I was 8 years old. So I've known him for a long time. He's a good guy.
Well, we're rooting for him. Anyway,
I'm actually lucky. All the weddings I've been to, no one's been divorced. Everybody's going pretty well. That's good. So it's good.
That's amazing, Randy. That's a string you got there.
Yeah, I can't think of any divorced friends that I have that I've actually been to their wedding. So that's good. That's a good sign. So
you must know some good, reasonable, easy to get along with people. How about that?
I hope so. I hope so. I hope so. I hope that's the case. That's the reason. So we were really excited to read the book. Great read. I know, Chris, you wanted to start it off with a question just about process. So the floor is yours.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a reporter, but I've never written a book before. Just how long did this whole process take from when the idea originated? How many people did you end up talking with? And what is the book writing process like to describe for everyone listening?
Good questions. I could ramble on this for a while, so cut me off when I become boring. But this one kind of grew out of the Cheated, the one that Randy mentioned, in the sense that, you know how it is when you're writing stories, Chris, even features and beat coverage, like one idea kind of grows out of another. And there was an element of Cheated, which was a portrait of how the Yankees had built up that era and then how they were so angered and heartbroken by facing a team that was cheating a number of times in the postseason, 2017, 2019. That doesn't get talked about as much. But anyway, just learning about how the Yankees had constructed that that era of what they called the baby bombers at the time. And I'd known, of course, and covered the organization and Cashman prior to that. But in doing that, I really kind of dug into interviewing Gene Afterman, Tim Nearing, other members of his front office, and digging into that. And I did have a bit of a seed of a thought, like, well, this is an interesting organization in itself. So maybe that's something to pursue. You're always looking for the next idea. And I've found that with projects as long as books, it has to be really organic and something you're really interested in. So it's like, oh, do I really want to write about the Yankees? I cover them on a daily basis. That could get tricky. But finally, ultimately, it was like the thing that I had to write about next. And the reason they interested me so much was because when Cashman had told me a story years ago that when he got there as an intern in 86, if you've read the book, you've read this, but he's one of his jobs is to transcribe the, not voicemails, but answering machine messages of the minor league affiliates. Oh, this is Wally Moon. I'm single A manager. Andy Stankiewicz let off and went 1-for-4 with a walk. But next up was, and now we're talking about bat tracking data today and bat all this Hawkeye cameras. And so you think about the Yankees have the kind of continuity to tell the entire arc of the advancement and the trajectory of the game over the past four decades because of their continuity. Leave aside their success or lack thereof or however one perceives it. It's just that, that continuity piece. So I wanted to do that. The other book came out in 21. In, I want to say, the fall of 21, I called Cashman and said, this is what I want to do. And it was a really awkward conversation, which I didn't expect because I've known him a long time. And he goes, okay. And it's like, you ever have to fill the silence in a conversation with like stammering and like, that was like one of those deals. So I was like, do you not want me to do it? He's like, nah. And it's like one of those, like, okay, whatever. We'll talk about this again. We get to the GM meetings. I sat him down. We had coffee. It was like, how about this? He gives me another, all right. I go, do you want me to drop this? I'm not going to like force it. If you're not into it, it wouldn't work. And he's like, no, you don't have to drop it. So I'm like, well, do you have any concerns you want me to address? No. So it was one of those, like, okay. So months are going by. And finally, I was able to have enough conversations with him where it was like, well, what's the problem here? Like, what are your reservations? And one, I think he didn't want to be perceived as having written a book or having had a ghostwriter or do a project like this or anything. He's still working. He's not getting any money out of this. There's a million reasons why he wouldn't necessarily think this was the time or this was the project for it to be his book. So we worked through that. And finally I said, okay, well, that's not what I want to do anyway. I'm not trying to ghostwrite your memoir. I want to do a work of journalism where I interview all the people I possibly can who have ever been around you. I want to interview you at length, but I want to tell a broader, more holistic story about the time that you've been with the Yankees. And the only agreement that we really ended up having was, all right, well, if that's the kind of book you're going to write, then I don't have the right to tell you to stop. Like, okay, good enough for me. And then you perform a high wire act of sort of keeping him talking throughout that process, which then took another 2 years or so to maybe more to your process question, Chris, constant reporting. I mean, when you're digging in on something like this, you want to do an interview every day. You want to talk to as many people as you can. Then you identify the people who really have good stories and really have a lot to tell you. In this case, Buck Showalter, Bill Livesey, the longtime Yankee executive who Cashman believes gets slighted in favor of Gene Michael in terms of building the dynasty. Gene Afterman was a great talker for this. People who were there, there were others, but you call these people back all the time with follow-ups. You have broader conversations, all the while keeping Cashman on board. Well, he's busy. He's distracted. For all I know, his enthusiasm's going up and down. So trying to have to make sure that he keeps talking. And then when you feel like you have enough information to start the story, you get to that writing phase. You're still reporting the whole time as you're writing. But I would say, Chris, at that point, it's not rocket science. It's just consistency. So with a day job that keeps us busy starting mid-morning till late night, you just get up early and try to write about 1,000 words a day. And if you write 1,000 words a day, you would be surprised how quickly you have a book length. I mean, let me think. I don't know, 6 months, a year. It's all a blur now. But if you were to add up the beat coverage you've written, it would probably be this thick in paper. So that's all you do is write a column a day, write a feature a day when you're really bearing down on it. And that's pretty much, that's the reporting and writing process. It demystifies it a little to actually do it. It's just what we do all the time, but a longer story.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Cause I was thinking it's like, it just seems daunting on its face. Like, you know, I think this book was like 280 something pages, if I remember correctly.
Something like that.
And it's like, I don't even know where to begin with that. But like most of my stories are around 1,000 to 1,200 words. So like when you put it that way, if you're writing it every single day, you know, over time, you would have enough material to have a book.
Yeah, I would say the minimum book length, I mean, it varies, but 60, 70, 80,000 words is a relatively short book. This one's about 95. And I used to think, how could I ever write 70,000 words about anything? That's massive. And then I'd look at people, I'm like, well, that guy's not that good. And he wrote 80,000 words. Why can't I do that? And eventually it's just like, you just, you know how to write. So you just do it. And you have to be really interested in the topic. That's the thing. Do you want to write the equivalent of 90,000 word features about this topic? It's a lot, so you better be into it. You can't fake it.
I did have one additional question, because you know, you're around the team, I'm around the team. Sometimes I feel like it's difficult to get people to talk about the team, especially on like on a day-to-day level. Did you find it easier to, you know, get in touch with members of the organization because you were writing a book and it wasn't, you know, filling your day-to-day coverage, or was it about the same? What do you say?
No, it was easier. People love to talk about their own histories. And even with Cashman, it was like, we're talking for 30 minutes about the Chuck Knoblauch trade. And then, so by the way, shifting into my day job for a second, have you called the Padres about Soto? I wouldn't say. Okay. So yes, it's easier to get people to talk about the past. And when it came to the current stuff, the book ends with a long section on Judge and the Judge free agency. And I was at the winter meetings for that. So the two, the daily and the book projects can support each other there. You know, I covered the Judge free agency. I was there. I made it my business to be as nearby the Yankee people in that hotel in San Diego as I possibly could, and to figure out what my coverage is about the Judge free agency moment to moment. So then you zoom out. When I got home, I banged that out. It was like, and what's everything I saw and everything I was around and the stuff that didn't make it into my stories, and it's not news anymore. So build it into a narrative way. So the line isn't exactly demarcated sometimes as dramatically as that, like the past, the present, it can blend. But generally speaking, yes, the farther back something is, the easier it is to get someone to talk about it. And in terms of the current stuff, you get them to talk about craft maybe more than like hot stovey trade rumory stuff. Like there's a section with Garrett Cole and Zach Britton where we've got them talking about analytics and pitching, and I'm not asking them to really gossip or tell stories from in that particular section, stories that are sensitive, really. It's just, talk about what you do. And that's probably a good way to get people talking about the present.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and actually talk about some of the things that you did write about in the book. And one thing I did appreciate about reading it and what you wrote is there's a lot of myth busting that goes on with how the Yankees have operated up until this point. The legacy and history of Steinbrenner, the legacy and history of Gene Michael and Buck Showalter. And it gives a lot of space and time and respect to other architects of the Yankees dynasty, and really just gives stronger context for how the Yankees arrived at where they are now and where they were in their dynasty years. And you mentioned Bill Livesey and Brian Sabian and a whole other host of characters that Jack Butterfield, the list goes on and on. Can you talk a little bit about why it was important to you to really bust some myths up about popular conceptions of the Yankees dynasty and how George figured in all of this and stick Michael? Why was it important to you to make sure that the other members of the other architects of the dynasty got their opportunity to shine?
Well, I appreciate you noting that, Randy. I would say, number one, I feel like I have one shot at telling this story. Of course, this is my book about Yankee history, and ambitiously, I want it to be the definitive version. I want it to be as accurate as it could possibly be for this particular story. I want to be the one to tell it right. And that phrase, telling it right, it was part of, could have been one of my answers to your first question, Chris, in terms of keeping Cashman aboard with being a source for this, an interviewee for this, was he would always say the story that's always told about the Yankees is wrong. So I was able to turn that on him and convince him to, well, let me tell it right. Whatever you think is right. And then I'll dig into those things. And he does feel that there's a shorthand of, it's complicated with Gene Michael a little because he doesn't mean this to take any respect away from him. Just like, why is it always only stick? And when I started to pull that thread a little, you mentioned the key names, Jack Butterfield, talk about a guy, I'll go back on this a little because your listeners wouldn't have read this book yet. That was something, Cashman pointed me to a guy named Bill Livesey, who I started interviewing. He's in his 80s now, fascinating guy. And someone who mentored Buck Showalter. Showalter finally was like, yeah, but you know, you really need to go back to is Jack Butterfield. I said, Brian Butterfield? No, his dad, Jack Butterfield. Brian's a relatively well-known coach of more recent years. So Jack Butterfield was a longtime baseball coach at the University of Maine, dating back to the 50s, 60s. He went to the University of South Florida to coach in the 70s. Chance happening, he had a dinner at a fundraiser next to George Steinbrenner in 77. Steinbrenner was so impressed with him, he said, well, you should do some scouting for us in your offseason. He's so good at that Steinbrenner finally hires him. He brings in Bill Livesey, who played for him, and these guys have this incredibly outside-the-box way to look at the game. They drew up something called a player profile, which ranks up that, well, Livesey drew it up, but he was influenced by Butterfield, who ranks the tools in order of importance for every position. The Yankees still use this. It's an explanation for why they played Brett Gardner in left field all those years later, because they rank speed and range in left field above power, which most organizations don't, or many organizations don't. I could go on. It's the reason why they moved Jorge Posada from infield to catcher, because his tools, I mean, that one you could have probably used your eyes for, but his tools are more suited to catcher than infield. I could go on. But because Steinbrenner happens to meet this guy at a lunch in the 70s, the whole organization goes on this different trajectory. They brought Brian Sabian in, who played for Bill Livesey. Jack Butterfield dies in a car accident driving over the George Washington Bridge from Yankee Stadium in 1979. Bill Livesey then is elevated to take his spot running player development. Livesey moves on to scouting and development through the 80s and 90s. And these were the people who really set the Yankee way, that when you talk to people that have had a tremendous impact since, Cashman, Showalter, Billy Epler, Mets manager Carlos Mendoza, Phillies manager Rob Thompson, all these people learn this Yankee way that comes out of all places, the University of Maine. And as a reporter, Chris, I don't have to tell you, when you discover something like that, that was sitting there hidden in plain sight that people don't know, it's an unbelievable feeling. There's stuff in there about Jeter and A-Rod and Torrey and Cashman and all the big celebrities. But I would have to say the most satisfying thing as a reporter in this book was probably learning where these Yankee ideas came from. I didn't even know Jack Butterfield existed. And he set ideas in a Yankee way that literally, I mean, we could go on. It's the reason they moved Gleyber Torres off shortstop. It's the reason they moved on from Luke Voit, what they tools they rank in a first baseman. I'll stop now, but I think you get my point. It's still so pervasive in the organization.
So to follow up on that, I make it very clear that I'm a big Brian Cashman fan. I'm the one. I agree with Billy Bean and Brian Sabian when they say in the book he's the greatest exec in baseball, Major League Baseball history. I know that like a lot of people will scoff at that, but I firmly believe that as well. Can you talk about, and one of the biggest criticisms for Cashman presently is that he's been there too long. And I think when people say that, they don't understand that this is a story of legacy and lineage that has led to the most successful franchise maybe in North American sports history. Probably is.
Yeah.
And that's valued. Like there's a great value to that for the Yankees because that's how they got to where they are. So can you talk a little bit about the importance of keeping someone like Cashman around because of the history and lineage of people like Bill Livesey and Jack Butterfield and now Brian Cashman?
And the reason I made that wisecrack is because the gulf between how Cashman's viewed by his peers and viewed by the fans who have the loudest voices publicly is unbelievably stark. I mean, the greatest of all time versus moron, fire him yesterday. That's an interesting thing right there. And I understand Yankee fans' impatience in the sense that they're used to enjoying championships all the time, but it's obviously a different game now. And yet, Randy, I agree completely. That continuity is unmatched. And I went and looked at this. I talked to Mark Shapiro, who came up in the Cleveland system, because they've been gone back a while, but only to the early 90s, where a guy named late 80s, early 90s, where an executive named Hank Peters was there. The A's, Sandy Alderson, early 80s, to Billy Beane, to David Forrest. That's a lineage that goes back pretty far. But the Yankees, you can trace it back to that lunch with Steinbrenner and Jack Butterfield in the 70s. You could even trace it back to when Gene Michael got traded to the Yankees in 68, when Mickey freaking Mantle was still on the team, and he mentoring Cashman. So, yes, that continuity is really important when you've had that kind of success. Obviously, fans get sick of hearing about the three decades of winning seasons, but that's the sort of thing that Billy Beane and Brian Sabian and other greats are in awe of. How do you not take a down year ever? That's crazy. So that's part of what that continuity brings you. And it's always a risk to abandon continuity. If the Yankees were to scrap their front office at the end of this year, and if they miss the playoffs and bring in a younger hotshot, like the Met version of the Mets bringing in David Stearns and starting over, well, you know what the last 30, 40 years have brought you. You never know. That's not to say the change is always bad, certainly, but their continuity and their continuity of ideas and philosophy and personnel have brought them winning seasons year in and year out. That's just the fact that we can't question. And that's why they're leaning towards further continuity and promoting a guy like Kevin Reese, who played for the Yankees, who's been in player development now for a while. That's the most likely successor to Cashman. So this is not, as long as the Steinbrenner family owns the team and there's no indication they're looking to move on anytime at all that we can see, then they're going to value that continuity because it's been working for them. If you have a couple of years or more where it stops working, then you rethink it. But to have that institutional knowledge is huge. What business hires and fires leaders every couple of years? Sports is kind of ridiculous that way. You'd want continuity, again, provided it's working.
One thing I was struck by when you mentioned continuity is, you know, like I said at the beginning of the episode, I'm 31. George Steinbrenner was banned in 1990, which was before I was alive. And just reading the book and, you know, all the stories that were told about George, it seems like all of his decision-making, well, not all, but most of his decision-making was erratic and off the hip. And I feel like a lot of people my age in particular kind of viewed George as a mythical figure in Yankee land. Maybe that's because, you know, I'm 6 years old. That's 1998. And most of my childhood is filled with championships and the Yankees being the best team in the world. So I guess my question is, why do you feel like, just after talking with people and, you know, being around the team for as long as you have, why do you feel like George has become this mythical figure in Yankees universe when it seemed like a lot of his decisions were just completely, you know, he woke up one day and just, you know, I'm on a fire Billy Martin today, or I want to name Brian Cashman the general manager. So why do you feel like he's become sort of a mythical figure? Is it just because, especially with my people my age, is it because we just grew up, you know, viewing championships left and right, or is it something else you think?
It's a great question. Talk about the difference between myth and reality at this point. Probably the timing of the fact that he went out on a very high note with a lot of championships in the latter part of his ownership. And he had a lot overall. There was a lot of success. Obviously, that can't be denied. But yeah, the leadership style, hiring and firing managers and GMs in the middle of the night, I mean, that would not play today at all. As it's become more process-based in the game. I guess it's, in fairness to Steinbrenner, we could view that in the sense that the game was a little bit more Wild West overall back then. But you had ex-players as GMs. You didn't have David Stearns types in there. You know, there wasn't the data. So owners were maybe behaving like that a little more regularly. But having said that, yeah, there weren't a lot of flattering things said to me in the reporting for this book about Steinbrenner, or George Steinbrenner, his leadership style. In fact, one quote from his son, Hal, was, people forget that my father wasn't well-liked at all, especially in the 80s. I was, oh, wow, you just said that. It's true. But that's from Hal himself, who has to be compared unfavorably to him. So that might be part of what animates a statement like that. And there was another quote in the book of, people forget how it was Ding Dong the Witch is Dead when he was banned. Tony Kubek on the Yankees broadcast said that the Yankees should have a Howie Spear a day, the gambler that he was associated with that got George banned. Can you imagine on Yes, something like the How Hated? I mean, I know Hal gets a lot of crap, but like, Matt, it got to the point where, what if Paul O'Neill on Yes was like, thank God Hal's gone. I mean, that's how bad it got with George. And people just completely forget that. You know, you have his looming portrait in the right field bleachers to remind everyone. It's almost like the way he's set up is iconic in the most literal way of what an icon is. And that serves the Yankee brand, and it's something that they lean into. But yeah, privately, it was tough. It was a hostile working environment. People didn't want to work for him. And frankly, he made Gene Michael's life a living hell. He made Brian Cashman's life a living hell for a lot of years. And I would ask Cashman a couple of times, why did you want to take this job? Why did you want to work for this guy? And he said things like, well, I was raised in this environment, so I figured I could handle it better than anybody. One revealing thing I thought was when I said to Cashman, why did Stick stay throughout all this? And Cashman said, I don't know, the money. So all these stories about love and loyalty, sometimes, you know, that's easier to say in retrospect.
When I was in spring training this year, I was talking to Ron Bloom, who's with the Associated Press. Yeah. And Ron's been around for a very, very long time. And he was telling me stories of, like, when George was owning the team, like, reporters couldn't leave the stadium until, like, they knew George had left for the day, just because, like, they didn't know if he might fire someone or whatever it might be. So, like, sometimes they would be leaving the stadium at like 1 or 2, and George would come down to the press box and, you know, give his spiel or whatever. And then they'd have to like call into their newspapers or news outlets because, you know, at the time, you know, internet wasn't a thing. So I just found it fascinating, like thinking of like how things are now, you know, game ends, we go down, speak with Boone, go in the clubhouse, and that's basically it. Like, we're not expecting news for the most part. Maybe there's been a couple of times in the past 2 years that I've been covering the team that something's happened, like right after the game, Dylan Lawson was fired. We knew that was coming down. But yeah, for the most part, it's like, it's a regimented routine. Go down, talk to Boone, go to the clubhouse, come up, transcribe, write the story. Whereas it seemed like when George was around, it was like all hell could break loose at any second. So I definitely just found the comparison between George's ownership and Hal's ownership, just like they're two totally different people, it seems like.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And I asked Hal directly. Now, I wasn't there for that, but I've interviewed people about it too. You talked to Ron. I've talked to Michael Kay about that period of time for the book. And so I've heard those stories too. I didn't live it. But Hal, I asked him directly, are you trying to define yourself against who your father was as a leader? And he said, no, I'm just a very different person, but I understand why people might think that. And yeah, that was very dysfunctional and very difficult place for people to work. Now, again, they had success, so I don't want to completely forget that. And I think one thing that George Steinbrenner was really good at was being aggressive, pushing your chips in, recruiting. So people think that he built up the 70s dynasty. One of the little things I realized, and I surprised Cashman because he believed the myth too, was that, no, the CBS ownership acquired Greg Nettles, Guidry, Munson. George inherited a core there. But one thing that George did that plenty of owners wouldn't have been able to do, bring in Catfish Hunter. The Yankees are back. Free agency is a new thing, and we're going to be aggressive. Lure Reggie Jackson. So he was good at putting those finishing pieces on and stepping on the gas. But then the next dynasty they had, the 90s, obviously that doesn't happen without George's suspension, because he would have wanted to trade Bernie Williams. He did want to trade Bernie Williams a million times. Gene Michael had to do crazy things. Like, one time George said, trade Bernie, call all the teams and find out who wants them. This is like early 90s, I think. Maybe just after his suspension. And Gene Michael called every team, but he didn't, he called every GM, hey, how you doing? How's the wife? But he didn't actually talk about Bernie. So then he could go back to George and say, I called every team. So he had to like finesse it like that. So he goes away, that enables the Yankee dynasty. But when he comes back, he does, like, his aggressive behavior helps keep that dynasty alive. He was good at being in that winning moment. And then it becomes too much again. You get to the early 2000s. Kevin Brown is on the team. Kenny Lofton's on the team, even though Williams is still on the team. Who's the center fielder? It gets kind of bad again. Cashman has Vlad Guerrero signed. And George goes, no, 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 I just did Sheffield. You can't have Vlad Guerrero. Like, what? Like, it got crazy again after a few years, and then they stopped winning championships. But he did know how to be aggressive in the moment when they're winning. That's one thing we should give him credit for, I guess.
So we'll continue our conversation with Andy. We'll get into some of the Jeter, A-Rod, Cashman stuff, some Dynasty stuff, and then we'll get to your mailbag. So we'll be back right after this break. And we're back. It's Randy, it's Chris, and our special guest, Andy Martino from SNY, author of Cheated and author of the new Yankees book, The Yankees Way, the untold story of the Brian Cashman era. Everybody's favorite era, if you're listening to this, because that's the only era that most of us have have experienced so far as Yankees fans. So there's a large portion of the book that gets into Cashman's relationship with Derek Jeter, Jeter's relationship with A-Rod, A-Rod's relationship with everybody, which is, of course, all very complicated things. So obviously, I have a history with Derek and spoke to Cashman and Alex, and there's things that I learned. But what were some of the things that you learned while you were doing research for this book and interviewing people that stood out to you?
I would say the depth of the antipathy between Cashman and Jeter at certain times. I knew basically how it was, but it got pretty rough at times. I would say I learned that Cashman got his house broken into once when all the A-Rod stuff was going crazy and no one knew what that was all about. So that was a weird thing to learn. I would say a lot, I'm going to give you a lot of credit here, Randy, and I'm really sincere about it, is that my goal in portraying those three guys was to present fully realized characters, have empathy for them, be fair, and present it as fully as possible. And you got stuff out of Jeter that helped me understand his motivations that no one's ever gotten. I thought that because Cashman criticized him so often for being closed off, whether it was to A-Rod or some other teammates. And that's, as we know, one of the reasons it's documented brought in CC Sabathia trying to revitalize the clubhouse culture because it becomes stale under Jeter. When he opened up in your film about the friend that told him he did not, I don't want to, how would you put this? He did not support interracial marriages, right? That, according to Jeter, if I'm understanding this interview correctly, helped to one of the reasons why he had some trust issues, because he trusted this guy. And then this guy really hurt him by saying that later. So just a detail like that was so much more than we've ever learned from Jeter. So I learned that from your work, actually. And that contributed to my book. So trying to figure out why those two guys, Jeter and A-Rod, were so complicated around each other was interesting. And I think Jeter's, the reasons behind his insecurities, that was a big piece that was interesting to dig into. And that's where I felt like my work was in a little bit of a conversation with yours in a way that I appreciate it.
Yeah. I know there are a couple of people that, when they watch the captain, were like, why am I bringing race into it? And it's like, the way he looked at the world. I mean, that's why he became one of the greatest Yankees ever. I mean, that was kind of like the chip on his shoulder. And I don't even think until we had those conversations with Derek, I don't think Derek ever put the two things together, you know, because I had asked him, and he had trouble answering this question. I had asked him flat out, like, you keep mentioning that you thought you were on stage when you played baseball, but you were very tired and like angered by the looks that you got when you were a kid, just walking in the street with your parents. You know, what's the connection? Mm-hmm. Obviously there's a belief that you want people to see you like on this stage, but you can control what's going on as opposed to the looks that you couldn't control. And it was, he had difficulty answering that question. He agreed with me, but he couldn't really put it into words because I don't really think he had connected the two. And that was why mm-hmm. we went down that route, because it informed his ability to and his desire to become one of the greatest Yankees baseball players yep. ever. And I think the example that you use about trust issues is a great one, because I think it shows it created the line between Derek and Alex, you know, that not to speak for Derek, I don't want to do that, but it's just that Derek is very quick to determine if he can trust you or not. And I think that Derek, the same thing happened with Derek and Alex. Derek trusted Alex, and then he felt like he got stabbed in the back with some multiple comments that Alex made. Everybody knows the story here, and he's not coming back from it, you know? And I think that only started to happen once Derek got married. And I think his wife, Hannah, put things in larger perspective for Derek that, you know, you can let it go. This doesn't have to last forever. Like, life is short. But I think one thing that I also found interesting is the relationship between Derek and Cashman. And one thing that I learned actually speaking with Cashman is that a lot of people protected Derek because he was a superstar. And it wasn't because Derek necessarily asked for it, but people had things invested in Derek that, you know, they had to protect Derek to protect themselves. And that was one thing that I found very interesting in talking to Cashman. I think you touch on in the book as well. And you have certain people that were a part of that. So can you tell us a little bit about that dynamic as well?
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I want to say that what you brought up about what you got out of him. I mean, that just, when I'm writing a book like this, those two, like the most base level version of this book is like those two are just like pampered superstars and I'm criticizing them and it's kind of tabloidy. So to know that about Derek was huge. Same thing with Alex and his issues that he had with his father. He's playing winter ball as a teenager, as a prospect. His father comes and wants to reconnect with him right at the beginning of his career. It's this painful thing and he's in tears. I think when people behave questionably, if we want to have empathy, obviously we all behave questionably and there are always reasons and traumas and whatnot. So I think that motivated both of them. And so your work helped me with that. In terms of the Jeter dynamic with Cashman, Cashman did believe, and in fact, you reported on this briefly in your doc, and I wrote the scene as well, they sort of made peace when Jeter approached Cashman at his Hall of Fame ceremony in 2021. And Cashman made kind of an oblique reference in that conversation to, hey, look, there were people around you that were lying to you. And it was my job to give it to you straight. And Cashman felt like their relationship probably suffered because he was the one that would be like, dude, you're not a shortstop anymore. Like, come on, Robin Yount moved to the outfield. Why can't you? And there'd be things like, there was one time when Willie Randolph, as a coach for the Yankees, sees Jeter and Luis Soho kind of making funny faces at each other, screwing around, not taking their pregame work seriously, says to Willie, talk to Jeter about that, please. And Willie goes, okay, I talked to Derek. And then he goes, Cashman mentions it to Jeter. He's like, Willie never talked to me. Same thing with Torrey. Could you talk to Derek about moving positions? Yeah. I got it, Cash. Joe never talked to me. So it's like people were tiptoeing around him. And it's difficult to communicate with someone when they're not even getting the message that you wanted to receive to them. So that created that dynamic. And then just Cashman felt over the years that, and he wasn't the only one, front office felt this way, that there was a caste system that developed after about 04, around about that time, the people who had won championships and the people who hadn't. And whether you were Alex Rodriguez or whether you were a reliever who was up for a couple of days, the old guard just wasn't really being warm to you. And there wasn't this sense of team. And Johnny Damon gets there, who's this garrulous guy, and he was kind of frozen out of that and not really a part of that. And he finally comes into his own in 09 when it's Damon and Swisher and CC, and the whole culture changes and gets away from that traditional Jeter culture. I'm not here to say which is better or worse. The first way had more success in terms of championships. So you could look at this a number of different ways, but Cashman just came to feel that Jeter, he would say, you're supposed to be the captain of everyone, meaning he didn't feel like he was acting like the captain of anyone. And I will say that the comparison of my reporting on Aaron Judge, his captaincy that's happening currently now seems very different. And that, and Chris knows this, I'm sure, even better than I do, being on the beat. It seems like just about every player on that roster feels pretty connected to Judge in some way or another. Judge is taking care of them, giving them personal time, giving them attention, giving them support, no matter who you are, whether you're a star, whether you're there for a couple of days. And that was what Cashman in the front office felt like Jeter wasn't doing as captain by the end.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell a quick story about Judge. I did a story on him going into last season where I asked every single player on the roster, because this was Judge's first year as captain, if they had like a story that, you know.
I remember that. Yeah,
whether he touched him personally or whatever. And I was struck by like everybody, no matter if they were Giancarlo Stanton or Ron Marinaccio, every single one of those guys had some sort of personal interaction that like meant something to them. And I thought that like really showed like who Judge was like behind the scenes, because, you know, one thing that I was thinking of, you know, before I got on the beat, it was like, I feel like just from watching from afar, it seems like it's an act. Like, is someone like this gregarious to players, or are they really like that, like connected with the guys? And, you know, since being on the beat, like it, I've learned that it's really not an act. Like, that's who Judge is at his core. Yep. So that's something that I've certainly learned just from now covering the team as opposed to when I was watching from afar.
I agree with you completely. I remember your reporting on that, and that's what I see too. So that's an interesting contrast. And this is not to kill Jeter. Jeter was one of the greatest players any of us has ever seen. He lived in the public eye for all those years, scandal-free. There's so much positive to say about Derek Jeter. So I don't want to get too lost in this, but in this idea of leadership, there's no question that this inclusivity that we're talking about from Judge is not what the Yankees saw in Jeter's captaincy, to the point where they wanted to change the clubhouse culture. And I'm sure that Jeter could and has to a degree in your film, said things about Cashman that he didn't like. I mean, it takes two to tango in any rivalry like this. But, you know, those are some of the things about Jeter that definitely rubbed the Yankees the wrong way.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting not just hearing from Derek about it, but like pretty much everybody that was there about how, you know, over time, just dynamics changed. And a lot of it, I think, outside of the Jeter A-Rod stuff, a lot of it was kind of like victims of your own success. You know, that in every stage of the dynasty, during the championship years, post-championship years, up until 2009, everyone was kind of trying to figure out how do we keep this going. And like everybody kind of made decisions that contributed to it not going the way that it was going before. You know, like obviously O'Neill and Tino and all those guys left. And then George started to feel himself a little bit and started to interject himself. Cashman had the battle in 2005 between him and the shadow front office in Tampa, which was a big part of like the issues that was going on with the team. There was the old guard that was still there with the new guys like Gary Sheffield, who was very vocal about that division. Like even when we spoke to him, he was very clear that it existed.
And then, yeah, it was great.
Not only that, like A-Rod and how he went about things and kind of like forcing the issue and trying to be cool with everybody also contributed to that. It just felt like everybody was trying to figure out how to get that secret sauce back to keep those championship years going. And like none of it worked for a while, you know, and it created those divisions.
Yeah. Those that I think you described those dynamics beautifully, and Sheffield did, you're right. And that, in his interview with you, it was too magical and perfect of a dynamic and organic to stay. And also you had, talking about going back to Cashman's thing about the story that's always told about the Yankees is wrong. He believes that the beginning of the end of the dynasty came in 1995, which was a surprising thing to hear, because these people like Bill Livesey and some others who are mentioned in the book that built this thing were let go. Some of them, like Sabian, were already gone. Showalter was already gone. So the figureheads of the winning, Joe Torre, for example, who deserves credit for a lot of that winning in his own way, but most of these people were gone, and G. Michael would never be GM again by 95, by the time they won their first championship in 96. So Cashman was not surprised to see these diminishing returns, because to his eye, the organization was already messed up before they even started winning. And it was just a matter of time till that caught up with them. By the early 2000s, it does.
So, oh, Chris, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think you had something you wanted to ask Andy.
Yeah, so you do a great job of covering the Jeter, Cashman, Casey Close, Hal Steinbrenner, Randy Levine beef during Jeter's final like big free agency, yeah. Which like in many ways was a shit show. I mean, I don't really know a better like phrase to like describe that moment in time, both then and even now. And there's a moment in your book that you referenced the captain, which I always appreciate. So thank you for that. There was something that I wanted to clarify though, because there's a line that mentions that the film was produced by Casey Close, which is true. But I think it's important to give some context of like how that worked, because
sure, please do.
I don't want people when they read it to think that Casey gave us notes to kind of like steer us in a direction for how that scene was portrayed in the film. So for people's backgrounds and you guys here, when we did the film, it was in association with Major League Baseball. So they were essentially a producer. And this is something we learned. Nobody told us this while we were making it, but we found out that if there's like X amount of time spent on a particular team, or if like X amount of times a team's logo is shown, that team automatically by rule, by contract, whatever it is actually a producer, and then has an opportunity to give notes and like approve essentially whatever depiction there is of the team. So like, because we had, obviously you're going to show Yankees logos all over the place, the Yankees can become involved and MLB kind of becomes that like go between. So we ended up showing a whole bunch of cuts to the Yankees, all the episodes. We didn't know we had to do this. Like all of a sudden, like the Yankees are saying, yeah, we approve this. And we're like, okay, like we didn't ask, but then we found out that
that's not part of the process that a creative person needs during the process.
Right. The Yankees are great. The Yankees are great. The only point of contention actually was the Jeter free agency.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't get any notes from Casey Close. Casey kept himself out of it. And it really was, I ended up getting more notes from the Yankees and Cashman than I did. Certainly Casey Close and even Derek. Derek stuck to his story and he said, this is what happened. Cashman did the same. And the Yankees were like, well, this is not how it went down. It went down like this. So there were so many like back and forth between the Yankees and Derek and like MLB and all this stuff that we wanted to play it down the line, because that was how we wanted to approach the entire film. This wasn't meant to be a hit piece. Like we spoke about Alex. I could have easily made Alex look like a buffoon, but like didn't want to do that because that's not my place. And that's not fair to him. And Derek didn't want it to be a hit piece on anybody. But it was interesting in reading that section, because I got more notes from the Yankees than I did anybody else. And I even was with Brian Cashman in his suite and he was still talking to me about it. And the film was done. It was out. And like Cashman still had things to say about it.
Oh, right.
So I just wanted, you know, when people read it, I just want to give like a fuller context for how that process works, because it's not as much as like somebody's a producer and they're listed on it. So it means X, Y, and Z. There's so many like other factors that even I didn't know about until we started doing it that like gets us to that point of what people actually see.
So you would be concerned about an implication potentially that Casey was driving the bus on something like this, even though he was listed
yeah, because
as a
I,
producer. And that's what you'd, yeah, I understand what you're
because
saying.
Because that's not, there were multiple people
gotcha
throughout the time that when it came out, they just saw his name and were like, okay, well, they're influencing what happened. And that, I mean, the honest to God truth is that is not what took place. Like, Casey did an interview with us, and in fact, we didn't include much of Casey's interview because we wanted it to be about Derek and Cashman, because those were the two primary people that were involved. And I think a lot of people naturally, and I get it, you see someone's name in the credits, you think that, oh, they must have this influence. And also part of it is influenced by The Last Dance, you know, because people, I didn't work on it, so I don't know if it's right or wrong, but like felt like Michael was tipping the scales a lot. Especially with Jerry Krause, who
did feel that way. I think there's a whole conversation there that's separate from this one to be had about player, athlete, team driven. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, actually, because what Chris and I do is rapidly going away. So it's like, well, what's going to replace it? Which is a scary topic. Right. And The Last Dance, obviously, Derek and Players Tribune and Casey had some business involvement and what you did. I hope it's clear how much I liked what you did, but you know, there was that involvement there. Whether it's even Welcome to Wrexham is like propaganda by owners. It just happens to be entertainingly done. Right. So this is like in-house content is now the thing. So that creates all sorts of interesting questions or assumptions or implications about how that actually functions. So that's good that you, interesting for me to hear that you drew that out. And I can certainly believe that it was the Yankees who had a lot to say about it. I obviously reported on this myself. I know it's a raw topic because at root of it, this actually probably took me more time than most of the other things I did for the book. Because at root of it is Casey Close calls Mike Lupica on a Sunday and says, basically, the Yankees have turned this into a public negotiation. We agreed it wasn't going to be. And the Yankees are going, we were pissed. Like now we were, they're still saying we were pissed off because Casey Close and Derek Jeter fired first. And Lupica's calling who fired first. So I did what I'm sure you did, which was go back through the clips meticulously. And like, what pissed them off? What was it? Close and Jeter. And it turns out it's kind of a split decision. Cashman's right. And then he wasn't quoted in anything at all prior to that Close column. So he goes, he's thinking like, why am I the bad guy? Even in Derek's interview with you, it's like, I didn't want to talk to Cashman. I didn't want to see him again after that. Cash is like, I didn't say anything. What are you mad at me for? That's his perspective. But I went back through and I read everything that was written. The GM meetings had been the week prior to that Lupica column. From the GM meetings, Wally Matthews at ESPN, Anthony McCarron, my former coworker at the Daily News, and who else? I feel like there was one more that slipped in my mind. There were a couple of stories that quoted anonymous Yankee anonymous sources from a Yankee perspective. And Cashman's like, I don't know who said that. It wasn't me. Like, he's going to take that to his grave. And so it's irresolvable in a way. But that was my thing going through it too. Like, I'm trying to find the smoking gun that set Casey Close off, and I couldn't quite. But
I think everybody was. We couldn't find it either. I mean, it was just like everybody was just mad at each other at one point, and nobody can identify what made everybody so mad. Like, what was the first shot? Because when we spoke with Cashman, he definitely mentioned the Casey Close thing. And when we spoke to Casey, he said, well, I was responding to something that was said already.
Right.
And it was just like, okay. Like,
and Cashman, he even had Jason Zillow, his media relations guy, when he was preparing. I don't know if you know this. I think I put it in the book. So he went through, Z, can you find me what I did wrong, please? And I'll admit it. Like, before he went for your interview, and it was what we're talking about, this irresolvable thing where it's like some, like there was one where Derek, what does he want to do? Go play in Cincinnati? But that wasn't attributed to anybody. And again, Cashman will go to his grave saying that wasn't him. I don't know who that was. So I don't know who it was either.
Yeah, I actually had a long conversation with Cashman before we interviewed him. Like he called me and I think we spoke for like 45 minutes. And I mean, it was a great conversation, but he had detailed like what his concerns were and he wanted to be really respectful towards Derek. And I said, I get it. But like the whole point is to tell your side of the story. Like,
right.
I mean,
right.
Derek's a big boy. If you see it a different way, he's just going to have to deal with it. I mean, you guys already had confrontations. Like, I don't really care about you respecting right. him. I want you to tell your side of the story. And I think that relaxed him to tell as much as he was willing to tell, because again, he's still working. Like he still has to work with Casey Close. Mm-hmm. You know, he's mm-hmm. still a GM. So I was mindful of that as well. I know he wasn't going to air everything out because he's still the GM of the Yankees. Like you have to be reasonable about stuff. So he had told me that, you know, he was looking through to see like, did he say something to set Casey off? Like, so, we had like a really good conversation about it. It was just interesting to hear, to be in the middle of like both sides.
Oh, I lived it too. Yeah.
It was fun because you're like in the middle of this, but it was also mm-hmm. like very interesting to see how like dug in both sides still are on it. You know, mm-hmm. I do believe Derek and Cashman have let bygones be bygones. I do believe that. But like these moments are still raw for both of them, which I still find like very interesting.
I think that that moment they had at Cooperstown in 21, I know that meant a lot to Cashman. I know that was something that helped. But it didn't immediately precede the families going on vacations together or a lot of dinner dates or anything. And it won't. And that stuff definitely runs deep. I think as they get older, it's like, well, why hold on to it? But, Derek still said what he said. It was pretty pointed in your interview about didn't want to talk to him again. Didn't want to see him. It was great stuff. It was honest. There you go. I think when you've got the icon of the era and the architect of the era, you're going to have egos. You're going to have conflict. It's not as bad as what went on with Jordan and Jerry Krause, apparently, really, when it comes down to it. But it's two titanic figures coming in the franchise, coming from different perspectives. And at the end of the day, I think that's irresolvable to a degree.
I agree. Chris, I know you wanted to ask Andy about your feelings on how Long Cashman might be doing this and, you know, more like present day stuff.
Yeah, I was interested in your reporting. I believe it was last week when you talked about Kevin Reese being a potential successor, because that was in the mm-hmm. book, which people will end up reading. Was that something that you felt was imminent, or was that part of, you know, this is part of the book and, you know, I'm trying to get people to...
No, I'm trying to sell the book. Yes.
So like what was the thing? Cause it definitely seemed like it came out of left field. Cause you know, it's early May and
it came out of my books coming out. Buy it. No, really. This is part of the deal. Right. I thought about pitching that around, like, you know, you have excerpts and stuff and or going to the guys in the beat and you're interested in this, that kind of thing. And ultimately I'm going to write this myself cause I'm comfortable with the material. So that's why I wrote it. But I do think nothing's imminent in terms of change, but it'll be interesting to see how the next couple of years go. Because as it says in the book, this is something I was surprised by, to your earlier question. I was surprised by how strongly Cashman, albeit briefly, weighed leaving after his last deal expired after the 22 season. And another thing I was surprised by was when I interviewed so many people in the front office, they would say to me, so do you think he's like done after this deal? Like it's being rampantly speculated about among the people who work with him. And there's a clear sense of, in some ways he's over it. In some ways he's still like really engaged in trying to build a winning ball club, but he's over all our bullshit. We saw that in Scottsdale at the GM meetings, you know, it's like if there were, I don't know, like he's down to, not being as invested maybe in some of the reporter relationships and things that form like a GM job. So people are wondering, is he getting to wrap it up? So I asked him directly. He was coy about it. But he was open about the fact that he engaged with Korn Ferry, the search firm, last time around before he re-signed with the Yankees. had some bigger picture thoughts. Oh, what would I do? So I think he's tired of being beaten up on social media and in this market, and he's disengaged from following the coverage and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised, although it's certainly not a certainty, if the transition plan comes into play pretty soon over the course of this contract. And the reporting I did to figure out how that would go clearly identified Reese as a guy who they feel would be in that tradition. Worked in pro scouting, player development, has that player voice, very invested in analytics to the point where he's, if there's a knock on him, it's that he's really into analytics, but strives for that balance that that the former players, the scouting community, that also brings to the Yankees. So, and then I wrote it because, as I said, gotta drive traffic to that Amazon page, Chris. This is a business. No, but yeah, that explains the timing. It was like a little newsy-ish thing I had in the book, but I do think if they win, let's say the Yankees win the World Series this year. Now I'm completely speculating how this could go. Would it shock me that Cash would be like, oh, we got one more? All right, now I'll start to just talk about what's next. And Kevin Reese would be at the forefront of that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually had the pleasure of building up a friendship with Kevin that actually started in 2020 when everything was like going crazy. And this is biased when I say it, but I think that would be like a great move for the Yankees because, mm-hmm. again, we're talking about lineage here. So I don't really think the Yankees would look outside of the organization, right, just because they're, and people will realize this when they read your book, like how entrenched they are with their own approach in every single facet of baseball operations, business. Like it has really, really strong roots. And I think Kevin Reese is one of those people that's young enough, that's modern enough, aware enough of like what's happening in modern day baseball, but was also a Yankee. So he understands all of those elements. I know that he's very, very appreciative of Cashman's process of collaboration when they make decisions. And I just think that if you haven't, they're going to go with an internal candidate. Kevin seems to make the most sense, like on a lot of levels. And even on a personal level, Kevin is very aware of what's happening in the world, you know, like beyond baseball. Like he's very aware of like the human side of things and is very sensitive to stuff like that. Not to say that Brian Cashman isn't, but I think that was the main reason why we hit it off, because we had conversations about things that went beyond baseball. And I think to have someone in that position who is also well aware of what's happening in the world around with these players and that players are dealing with something much different would be a benefit to the entire organization. So
that's a really interesting perspective. I don't know him on that level. I think that's interesting. I'm not going to presume what those things are. I know you're not here to speak for Kevin, but it sounds like Cashman's made strides. I think a lot of the issues there were so many issues globally in 2020. And the Yankees were probably one of the more open organizations for facilitating conversations around race and around what was happening then. And I feel that the game has really fallen off since 2020 with awareness and kind of gone back to where they were, where everything was prior to that, if not worse. I mean, that's the way the world is, right? I mean, every corporate. I could go on. I won't go on. But that's not what we're here to talk about. But an awareness of the broader world outside, Hawkeye camera tracking of bat speed is definitely a plus. And if Kevin Reese brings that, all the better.
Yeah. All right. So we'll take our last break. Then we'll get into the mailbag questions. We will ask Andy about Juan Soto because everybody wants to know about Juan Soto. So we will get into the mailbag right after this break. Okay, and we're back. It's the Views from 314 Feet podcast. It's Randy, it's Chris, and our special guest, Andy Martino. So we'll just jump right into it. The burning question that everybody wants to know, have there been any extension talks with Soto? You know, what's the update on Juan Soto being a Yankee for life?
It's hard to prove a negative. I can't say absolutely definitively that there have not been, but I probably could come pretty close. This was why on God's green earth would Scott Boras have this had this conversation without involving Steve Cohen first when he can in November, and a few other owners that might be able to think about affording him. Soto has been so disciplined about. Have you noticed that he hasn't really leaned in verbally into like the whole Yankee aura and mystique? It's like, how was it to debut with the Yankees, to wear the pinstripes for the first time? Oh, it was great. It was really great. But he's not going overboard with that. He's in the moment. He's not committing to anything. And again, when you have a guy who's probably going to, it depends how you want to calculate Ohtani's contract, but could easily become the highest paid player ever in real dollar, current dollars. There's just no benefit to that side from talking about it right now whatsoever. So whether they might have some cursory check-ins, I suppose it's possible, but the Yankees knew before they traded for him that this was a one-year deal and anything else would be totally separate. Tell me, Chris, if you hear anything different, but my sense reporting on the team this year is that no one's really thinking about that yet.
Yeah. Cashman talked at the mural unveiling outside the Bronx mm-hmm. Children's Museum. And obviously we asked about Soto. And he said that they have not had any conversations.
He said it definitively. There you go.
Yeah. He said no, yeah. No conversations about an extension. And that's really been the case every time that we've spoken with Cashman. So it's not going to change. It's not happening. You signed with Scott Boras as your agent because you were looking for the largest payday possible, and you're not getting the largest. You may get the largest payday if you take an extension, but you're not opening yourself up to any possibility that may be on the open market. So for the fans like thinking that Soto's going to sign an extension because, like Andy was saying, like, oh yeah, the Yankee mystique, wearing the pinstripe, that's not happening. And also, I've definitely found it fascinating just from talking with Juan one-on-one how careful he is about answering questions that have any sort of would provide like any sort of insight into his thinking. He is not going to do that. I'd be stunned, actually, if he did that before the end of the season. I think he's very he's well trained when it comes to answering questions, when it comes to like which way he might be thinking. Cause right now there's no sense of if he's actually going to stay, if he's loving it, whatever it might be. So
yeah,
extension's not happening.
Very impressive, by the way, 25-year-old guy. First of all, I'd be willing to bet that you guys are jackasses at 25. I certainly was. I wasn't as on message or disciplined about anything. speaking in a second language, obviously just a very quick mind, good, very intelligent person. You know that when you're talking to him, and able to stay on message on something like this and thread a needle between not saying anything to alienate the Yankee fan, not saying anything and any we're close to negative about being here, but not fluffing it up so much that he's making it sound like he's tipping his hand over whether to stay. I agree. That's where it's going to be until the end of the season. But nicely done by him. He's an interesting, obviously very interesting person. All you have to just watch him play a lot there, but verbally very sharp too.
How my final point, I was going to say, you know, obviously with you being around the Mets, what is your indication of just what their plan is this off season? Obviously they have some money coming off the books if they want it. What do you think the Mets are going to do when it comes to Soto?
I think David Stearns will never advise having many, many long $300 million, whatever, 10-year contracts. They already have Lindor. They've got a tricky situation with Alonso, right? He's not a $300 million player probably, but what do you do there? That may or may not be resolved by the trade deadline. There's a lot of variables potentially complicating the Mets and Soto that haven't been resolved yet. There's no doubt that they will be part of his free agency as they were with the Yamamoto's, as they were, you know, he's 25 years old. He's so great. He's already here. And I just, it would be crazy for the Mets not to be involved. I think on the Mets side of things, Mets fans and Mets coverage is like I don't want to say an inevitability feeling that he's going to be a Met, but a lot of hope seems a Mets fans that he's going to be a Met. And it's like, what I say to that is like, guys, if the Yankee, if this keeps going the way it's going, if the Yankees let him go to the Mets, they're going to have to like pull down the gate, shut the door, stop, function. you can't like go out of business. You're done. You know, that's not the Yankees. He's too perfect. You can't let him go. That's what it's looking like to me right now. But it'll be interesting because Steve Cohen's a lot wealthier than anyone else. And I guess the reason I'm stating the obvious variables is because it hasn't progressed beyond that. But I will share that Met perspective. Is it like, oh, yeah, he's coming here? I wouldn't be so sure, guys. It'll be interesting to see that them square off. They didn't on Aaron Judge. They did on Yamamoto, but neither of them got Yamamoto. So is this going to be the first true free agent face-off between Steve Cohen and Hal Steinbrenner? That'll be really interesting to watch.
It'll be like WWE SmackDown or something between the Yankees and the Mets for Juan Soto. So, Andy, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. The book is great. I really enjoyed reading it. Like I said, one of the highlights for me is just the myth busting of like the Yankees dynasty and really just like clarifying things. And I hope a lot of people get to read it and really learn that, you know, this wasn't all about George Steinbrenner and, you know, the well-known names. And I really appreciate that. I appreciate the entire book, but especially the history aspect of it. I thought it was really fantastic. So thank you for joining us. And the book comes out Tuesday,
May 21st, which is,
May 21st.
Week from Tuesday, yeah.
All right, so a week from tomorrow when this episode
can be pre-ordered anytime.
Yeah, so, let people know how they can get it so they can get their hands on it.
Go to wherever you buy books. Go online right now. You can pre-order it, and that's about it. Or wait until Tuesday and buy it when it comes out in the stores. But either way, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this with you guys. Obviously, two people in your own ways provide very intelligent, interesting coverage of the team. Randy, I already said how valuable your work was to me specifically here. So this is a conversation I was hoping to have with you about this. So I appreciate you giving me the time.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Yeah. This book is the Yankee Way, the untold story of the Brian Cashman era with the Yankees. It's great. Highly recommend reading it. You'll enjoy it. You'll learn a lot. So thank you, Andy, for joining us. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys. See ya.
See ya.
See you later. That was great.
Yeah, that was good. And it's a great book. I really enjoyed it.
All right. So let's, since we're running longer than usual, let's go to one more break and then we'll get to the mailbag and then we'll wrap things up. And we're back. It's mailbag time. Thank you again to Andy Martino for spending some time with us. Go pick up that book. It's very good. Again, highly recommended. You'll learn a lot about not just the contemporary Yankees, but how the contemporary Yankees came to be. So if you're into that sort of thing, that's definitely a book that you want to pick up sooner than later. So mailbag time. First question is from Joshua Finchler. Hope you all had a nice Mother's Day weekend. Mine was cool. It was fine. I'm not a mom, but my mom had a good time. So that was good. Do we project any innings limitations impacting Heel or Nestor Rodon, given their lack of innings last year, could lead to different usage, six-man rotation, Phantom IL? I don't think you want to do Phantom IL the way that MLB's been cracking down on that, especially whenever Cole is back. So, Chris.
Yeah, this is something that I asked Matt Blake about in early April. I never wrote the story. I'm actually working on something long on Luis Heel, which I'm excited about. I'm not going to give away much information if competitors are listening. But one of the things I asked Blake early in the season was, you know, Heel's coming off of Tommy John surgery. He's in the starting rotation. Whenever you're in the starting rotation, obviously you're going to, you know, build up innings quickly. So one of the questions I asked is like, you know, in years past, like when I was growing up, you know, teams would say, you know, Luis Heel is pitching no more than 100 innings and that's it. He is not going over 100 innings. And it seems like the Yankees, I don't know if other teams are doing this, but you know, Blake is saying that they've moved away from this. I'll read his quote that he told me. He says, obviously, in conjunction with our sports science department and our minor league pitching department, just in terms of how we look at building up durability and volume and pitch counts, and maybe tracking that a different way in terms of how we think of what guys' work capacities are. It's really about managing the buildups and sustaining the workload than it is saying he can only go so far. I'd say the industry has just been asking more questions in the past 3 to 4 years about the arbitrary innings limit. There might be some research that says if you make these big jumps, these guys are more likely to get hurt. It's looking within those cases to see who are the guys who do get hurt in those scenarios. What were some of the things that you can look at to say this is an underlying reason why? And then, you know, Blake was telling me about all the ways that they can analyze how pitchers are bouncing back in between their outings. This was something that Nestor was struggling with last year, but for Heal in particular and the other pitchers on the staff, they can use so much technology in the weight room, in the bullpen to see just like how, like where guys are at. Like, you know, if you get a baseline of, all right, Luis Heal, he should be at this level. And then let's say 2 weeks from now, you know, he has that baseline test and it's well below where that baseline should be. Then like the Yankees are able to determine that like something is wrong here and they're able to, you know, scale back or obviously send him for testing if it might be that there's some, you know, mysterious injury that's affecting him. So there are other ways now where teams and the Yankees in particular can see just like how a player is performing, especially a pitcher. You know, they can use force plates in the weight room. They, in spring training, I don't think they do this in the regular season, but in spring training, they wear these like vests. They almost look like sports bras.
Right. Soccer players like, wear it.
Yeah. Yeah. So like they measure like workloads, especially, you know, if a guy is running, you know, 20 miles an hour and that's like his baseline. And then, you know, on Tuesday, his baseline's at 11, then, you know, that data would show like there's some sort of major problem. Whereas like with the eye test, you know, he may say he's fine, but like the data itself is saying otherwise. So there are ways that I find interesting that they can now measure, because like I was saying in the past, you know, teams would say he's only pitching 100 innings and that's it, and he's going to be shut down. So it's a long-winded answer of saying like I don't know if there's going to be an innings limit for him, even though they're saying there's not. They're certainly going to be cautious with him. You know, coming off of Tommy John surgery, which is the most extreme surgery a pitcher can have, Heal's not going to pitch 200 innings this year. He's just not going to. I would be stunned if he pitched 150 innings. That's why, you know, even though he's been unbelievable, like literally one of the best pitchers in the sport, he is very, very special. But because he's coming off Tommy John surgery, I don't know if they can keep him in the rotation for the rest of the season. I still think he's the likeliest candidate to come out of the rotation when Gerrit Cole is healthy, just because they can manage his workload. So it would be tough to take him out of the rotation, but I would also just get it from a workload perspective. And we've talked about how dominant he would be in the bullpen if he were to move there, because he's unhittable. Like no one can hit him. His command is not good at all. He's kind of like Blake Snell in a way. You know, Blake Snell won the Cy Young last year, and you know, a couple of years back, he walks a ton of guys. But when Blake Snell is on, you know, teams have a problem hitting him, and that's what we've seen with Heal. He is like teams can't hit him. Even yesterday, in Sunday's game against Tampa, he didn't have his strikeout stuff, and yet the Rays still couldn't hit him. Right. So like they have to find out a way to keep him fresh, because you know this team should be in October. They should be a playoff team. The way they're performing would suggest they're going to be a playoff team. And you want that guy healthy because he is going to make an impact in October with just how good he is right now.
Agreed. All well said. I don't have anything else to add. So we'll move on to the next question. Also, that's a great quote from Blake. Thank you for sharing that. I think that provides a lot of really great context for people when they look at how the Yankees are going to potentially handle all these rotation questions if everybody's healthy and Cole is back. All right, next question from Wally Herb Rodriguez. Are the Yankees considering designating Trent Grisham for assignment when Dominguez is ready? Dominguez showed last season he has it. He's a major leaguer. Grisham at $5.5 million is just a bad relocation of a resource. So I actually want to answer this first just because I have like some issues with the thought that's in this question. I looked it up and it's May 13th when we record this. And Trent Grisham has 37 plate appearances. I mean, he's not tearing the cover off of the ball, but he only has 37 plate appearances and it's May 13th. I'm not really following why everybody hates Trent Grisham. You know, like I think he's a bench outfielder who has a good glove. There shouldn't be any high expectations for him to like be some dominant hitter off the bench. I think he has a role. The Yankees have been healthy and they're so consistent with their lineup. He's not really seeing the field, so he's not a great hitter, and expect him to like tear the cover off the ball through 37 plate appearances, I think is unrealistic. I mean, he's a bench guy with like limited plate appearances. So I'm not really sure like why everybody has so much vitriol towards Trent Grisham. I know he's hitting into some double plays, but okay, so is everybody else on the Yankees. He's not like killing the team in any way. And we've spoken about this like multiple times with Jason. We don't even know if Jason Dominguez will be on the major league roster this season. I mean, they have three really good outfielders right now. They don't have any injuries. We don't know where Jason fits, and we don't know if he has it. He only played 8 games in the majors, an incredible 8 game run, but it's only 8 games and he's coming off a major injury. So we don't really know yet if Jason has it. I hope he does. You know, like I think he made as great a first impression as you can make for someone that just got called up at his age. But I mean, do you want to cut Grisham and eat $5.5 million for Jason Dominguez to sit on the bench? I mean, he's not going to be a starter if everybody's healthy. So I'm not really sure what the logic would be, or what the good logic would be in cutting someone and then paying him essentially a free $5 million deal or check for him to not be on the team. Then you replace him with one of your star prospects who's not going to play every day. So that doesn't really make that much sense to me.
No, I don't think this is a possibility. And also the Yankees have said on multiple occasions that they still – think Grisham will have a role at some point. It's just the fact that like you said, everyone's been healthy. They are playing well. So it sucks for Grisham that, you know, he was a starter in San Diego, but like, there's just no spot for him right now. There's no need to force Trent Grisham in the lineup when the team is playing well. And also, as we've seen over the past several years now, this injury luck that the Yankees have had, it's going to come for them at some point. That's just what that's the Yankee way. If you want to talk about the Yankee way is, you know, 15 guys getting hurt. So if someone's going to get hurt at some point,
exactly,
and Grisham is going to have a role. So like, I wouldn't even worry about Grisham's role right now. It's going to happen at some point. He's going to be playing. When it comes to Dominguez, again, like we've talked about on several occasions now, if they're continuing to play well, and Alex Verdugo especially, who Dominguez would probably be replacing if he were to, you know, be an everyday player. Well, he would be. He's not replacing Aaron Judge. He's not replacing Juan Soto. And Giancarlo Stanton makes $32 million, and he's also been productive. So, you know, we're really only talking about one player here, which is Verdugo. And Verdugo's been one of the best left fielders in the sport, not only defensively, but he's also hitting well. He's in a little bit of a slump right now, but, you know, if you look at his overall numbers, Verdugo's been one of the most productive left fielders in Major League Baseball. So there's not a spot for Dominguez right now. And also, like we've been harping on, he's played 8 Major League games. Those 8 Major League games that Dominguez played were absolutely meaningless for the Yankees. Meaningless. They had already given up their season. Dominguez wouldn't have been up with the Yankees last year if the Yankees were in it. So that's also something to note too. It's like Austin Wells, Dominguez, all these other guys that they signed off the street, like relievers, Anthony Misiewicz, Zach McCallister, like all these guys wouldn't have had a role on the Yankees if they were still in the mix in September. Like Dominguez was given free rein and Austin Wells was given free rein just because the Yankees were out of it and they were looking ahead to, you know, 2024. So I still don't think Dominguez is going to have a spot as it currently stands when he's healthy and if everybody else is healthy. Just because they are playing well, I expect them to continue playing well, and there's no reason to disrupt it. And also, as you said, he's coming off a major injury that it's not a given that a position player is going to come back and be himself. So there's no reason to rush Dominguez back when there's really no clear spot for him. And you also don't want him on the bench because he is still young and his development process is still not finished. So I am still of the opinion that we will not be seeing Jason Dominguez until September when rosters expand and, you know, he can play at some point down in the future. Because right now there's really no spot for him and it doesn't make sense to have him in a bench role and play 2 times a week. Cause you know, he has no experience doing that. He's always been an everyday player and you don't want to disrupt this guy's routine when you still have a lot invested in his personal future. So I would caution those people who are thinking that Dominguez is coming back and he's going to be inserted into the lineup and be an everyday player. I don't see that happening right now.
I don't see that happening either. And there are a lot of people, like you said, that mentioned Stanton, and it's like, you're going to have your young hotshot prospect learn how to be a DH on a major league level. And he only played 8 major league games and he's coming off a big injury. Like, why would he be the DH? You know, and I know people would say, well, you can have Judge or Soto DH. Why would you have them DH all of a sudden for Jason Dominguez? Like, I know people are excited about him. I get it. But, I mean, I think logic has to, like, win out here. You know, if Trent Grisham can't break the lineup, I'm not sure how Jason Dominguez can crack the lineup. I mean, Trent Grisham's an established Major League Baseball player with, like, 2 gold gloves. So,
Yeah, I mean, I don't see it. I also, it's also important to note that he's going to start his rehab assignment, I believe, tomorrow when this episode comes out. And he's going to DH for the first 2 weeks. And he's probably going to have a full spring training's worth of games before he's even considered a possibility. That's what they're doing with Oswald Peraza right now. He's going to play essentially a full 6 weeks, and then they're going to reevaluate where he fits, if he fits on the major league roster, which I don't even know he is going to have a spot just with how things are going right now. So we're still like 6 to 8-ish weeks away possibly of a potential Dominguez return. And also the Yankees are not going to rush him. They're not. Because they don't need him. You know, if it was Aaron Judge and, you know, he's you know, the Yankees are scuffling and he's obviously their highest paid player. And then, yeah, they may accelerate rehab, but there's no reason to accelerate Dominguez's rehab when there's not a clear spot for him on the major league roster.
I agree. Ryan, we got your mailbag question about Luis Gil, but I feel like we answered that in the previous question. So I think we got that one covered. So as Tim finishes his food in the background and is like banging on his food bowl right now for some reason, I think he's telling us to wrap it up. So we'll do that. Another great episode. Thank you again to Andy Martino for joining us and talking about his great book, The Yankee Way. Chris, any final thoughts before we get out of here?
It should be a good series against the Twins. The Twins are one of the hottest teams in Major League Baseball. The Yankees have been one of the hottest teams throughout the entirety of the season. So I'm interested to see just how things go against Minnesota. Yankees have had the Twins' number for basically my entire life, it seems like. So just interested to see where they stack up. And also the Twins are, you know, they're certainly a possible matchup for the Yankees in the postseason. So, you know, when you're watching the games, it's, you know, you can think of it that way. Because if the Twins win the Central, and let's say the Yankees are a wild card team, if the Orioles end up winning the AL East, which I still would project happening, you know, it's possible the Twins could be someone the Yankees play. So just keep that in mind when you're watching these games.
Cool. So you can find us on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Please give us a 5-star review if you feel inclined to do so. We appreciate any feedback that you might have on the podcast. Thank you for joining us. We will see if there will be another episode this week. If not, we will have a new one next Tuesday. And we will speak to you all soon.